tell us about your childhood, where you're originally from.
I grew up kind of, not quite inner city, but definitely city. Grew up in Quincy, Massachusetts, and just never really thought I was going to live in the country. Always was sort of planning on being a city person. And so very weird for me that I ended up out in the country. But grew up in a blue-collar family. I was the youngest of five, and my mom stayed at home and took care of the kids, and my dad was a ship fitter, very middle class, very blue collar.
Did you attend college?
And that was a little bit unusual for my family. Both of my parents were not college grads. I have a brother and a sister who have gone back now and gotten their college degrees, but I was kind of the only one who went to college straight out of high school. And I went to the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Kind of took me a few years to graduate. I'm getting ahead here, but Bob had already moved up here, and we were dating. And so I was coming up to kind of hang out with him and visit him in the summers. So that last couple of years of finishing school got pretty tough for me, because like I already knew I was going to be moving up here. And I was sort of thinking, why am I even bothering to finish this college education when I know I'm just going to go up and live in the woods.
So how did you guys meet? You guys meet at
UMass. Mm-hmm. My roommate, I lived in a suite. My roommate was Bob's next door neighbor. So that's how we met.
Oh, but he didn't go there.
He did not. No, Bob dropped out of school. He went to Springfield College in Springfield, Mass. Mm-hmm. And he dropped out of school. Because it was definitely not happening for him. He just didn't want to be in school. But went back years later and graduated from the University of Maine.
So, I guess, what motivated you guys? You said he was already living here.
It's a pretty cool story. It's pretty serendipitous. I don't know what the word would be for how kind of your life falls into a place. You know how life happens when you're busy making other plans? Really pretty amazing. So I was in school. We were kind of on and off again dating. I was thinking I was going to live in a city somewhere. I was sort of thinking about California. And the thing that attracted us to each other is that we were both really looking to engage life. And one of the very first things that we did when we were sort of hanging out as friends and dating is we left and went on this crazy cross-country road trip. And we had a couple of broken down cars, we hitchhiked, we took trains, but we were gone for over a year. And we were in all across the United States and Mexico and Canada. And so that kind of, we both had this real zest for wanting to do something different with our lives, but neither of us really knew what that was. And we were 19 and 22 when we did that. Then we came back, I went back to school, and he had come into a very small inheritance. If I told you the amount of money it was, you'd be like, oh my God, that's not much at all. But he knew as a 22-year-old that money was going to burn a hole in his pocket. So he said, I'm just going to buy a piece of land with it. Just kind of a real random thought. No, I'm going to buy a piece of land because I'm going to move back to the land. He was just like, I'm just going to do something with this money. And so he didn't even know where to begin. And a friend of a friend of a friend, that's how random it was, said, if you want a lot of land cheap, I know a realtor up in central Maine. And Bob was like, Maine? Okay, huh. Didn't even think about that. So he and his buddies started coming up on the weekends, and this realtor in Skowhegan, of all places, right, it was totally random, started just taking him around to pieces of property. And he was looking at old farms, and he was like, yeah, I just want a piece of land. I don't want a building on it. I just don't know what I want to do with it, but I think I just want a piece of land. So he finally brought him here, and Bob bought it and was just thinking, I'll come up here to camp. I'll just come up here to hang out. And around that time, I was thinking, all right, yeah, good for Bob, but that's not what I'm doing. I'm going to, go to California. So good for Bob that he's doing this land thing. Cool. Really happy for him. And started coming up to visit him. That's when we started coming up here and just meeting the people that were the Back to the Landers, meeting all of the hippies literally coming out of the woodwork. And we were just blown away by these people. They were so crazy cool, and everything that they were doing was just, it really spoke to our hearts. And I just realized, yeah, you know what? I'm going to move up there. I graduated UMass Amherst, UMass Boston, I finally finished at. Literally graduated school, loaded up my Volkswagen, and moved up here. And I've been up here ever since. So his story, so he was up here. There was this property. This house wasn't here. There had been an old farm that had burnt down, and the only thing that was on the road was this kind of shack. And so he was sort of living in this shack. I'm still going home to Massachusetts in the winters to do carpentry and work and make some money. And one day, literally, he was up here, and there was a knock on the door, and this hippie-type guy said, hey, I drive by your house every day, and why don't you come have dinner with me? And so Bob said that they just drove up a little ways up the road, turned down this driveway that you would not have even known was a driveway. It just looked like a path through the woods, and went like a half a mile down into the woods. And they get to this amazing house that this guy has built. And he's got a wife and he's got kids. And they have this amazing dinner. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, I've been up here for like 12 years. And, you know, I'm kind of living back to the land. And Bob went, whoa. And so he just realized, wow. And it just, like I said, it just really spoke to his heart. And he went, okay, I want to do this too. This is what I want to do. But we were definitely on the end of the curve, because we came up here in the late 70s, very early 80s. And so a lot of the hippies that were up here were 10 and 15 years older than us, because they had moved back like in the 60s and the early 70s. So everything was like already established. I mean, to even say that we knew we were moving back to the land is kind of a falsehood. We were just moving in with this community, and then we realized that, oh, this is the Back to the Land movement. These are the hippies that dropped out. And, oh, my God, how lucky for us that we just bought a piece of land in the middle of these people. We had no idea. And they helped us, taught us how to build, taught us how to do electricity, taught us how to grow a garden. When I think about that now, we moved in to this area, it was just in its full blossom of the real, totally working Back to the Land movement. Like, people were not using money, people were bartering, people were driving pretty junky cars, everybody was just kind of living incredibly minimally. And when we came in, it was just at the peak of that. And we were blessed with all of those people and all of their help. And probably 5 or 6 years after we moved here, the decline started, but it started very slowly. And it wasn't that they just kind of went back into society. For a lot of them, I think it was that their kids were starting to become teenagers. They didn't want to be homeschooled anymore. The kids were getting a little sick of living out in the woods without running water and electricity and that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of pressure, I think, for a lot of those people move into Waterville and get a real job and that kind of thing.
So since you say that, like, you kind of didn't know you were going back to the land, would you consider yourself like a Back to the Lander now?
Bob and I met this community and they embraced us so wonderfully. I think part of our zeal and our zest for wanting to live differently was how we really attached to them. We hadn't consciously thought we're moving back to the land, but when we met Back to the Landers, we went, oh yeah, that's what we want to do. I mean, we were a little bit younger than them, but we were still a product of the 60s. Growing up, we got the Boston Globe every day. The front page would be just covered with the Vietnam War and atrocious pictures. And Watergate, that movement of okay, we're dropping out because this is too messed up. The government is crazy, and we're trying to fight the Vietnam War, and nobody's listening to us, and now students are getting shot at colleges because of things that they believe in. We were not physically there, but we were aware of it because that was our junior high and our high school. So we were primed. We were primed to be people that embraced it.
We read a lot about these people who are like anti-war or anti-government. I was wondering if that kind of fed your disillusionment. And do you think that had you found another community that was alternative, that you would have embraced that? Or is there something about emphasis on farming?
I mean, it's hard to say in retrospect because we didn't, meet that other community, but potentially. But I think the thing that Bob really fell in love with was this idea that there was a community up here that was being self-sufficient, that was dropped out so that you needed to be a part of the commerce a little bit if you want. Like, when we first moved up here, we didn't even have a car. You know, we would just head out to the street and put our thumbs out. We were like, okay, we're doing this without money. Totally. We're back to the land. We're bartering for everything. So, yeah, growing food was part of that because you had to feed yourself. I totally think that you're right. I think that no matter how much you believed in the idea, if you didn't dig being a gardener, if you didn't really get into, which a lot of people didn't, you know, a lot of people came up and were growing food and then they were like, you know, growing food is really hard. I don't want to do this anymore. So, but Bob like totally fell in love with growing food. So yeah, so it was very easy for us to continue the lifestyle because we loved farming, you know, and we loved being that idea of being self-sufficient. Like, we still to this day, we sit down in the middle of the winter for a meal and everything on that table we have produced. And we just feel like our impact on society as far as our trash and our plastic and all of that stuff, it's minimal. Our carbon footprint is non-existent. Mm-hmm. Other than me driving a Kobe now, right?
Right. So you still grow all your food today?
We sure do. We have tried different things for about 15 years, maybe even a little bit longer. We were really growing commercially, and we were supplying to farmers markets and CSAs. And Maine has an amazing apprenticeship program through the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. So we did that, and we used to do the Waterville Farmers Market and the Skowhegan Farmers Market. All the years that we were here, I always had a part-time job at Colby. And then about 7 years ago, they offered me a full-time job, which was like a huge change for me. And right about that same time, we started to scale back on the farming too. So now, when we originally farmed, we were farming for self-sufficiency. And then we moved into the commercial farming for 15 years, and now we're back to farming for self-sufficiency. Saying that, we do a little bit of sales. We have a lot of chickens, so I sell my eggs at Colby. So, you know, during the school year, I've got 7 or 8 customers at Colby that I bring my eggs to.
Are you guys vegetarians?
We're not. We're both meat eaters. And one of the things that we did right off the bat was we learned how to grow and raise and butcher animals. We have never moved into large scale, though we've got plenty of friends that, you know, do pigs and cows. For about 5 or 6 years, we did lambs, and we just did it for ourselves. We weren't butchering and selling meat. Just yesterday, we butchered 8 chickens and just put them in the freezer. I truly believe, and I feel really good about the fact that if you choose to be a meat eater, being totally part of the process and understanding everything about that process and you know, raising those chickens from baby chicks and giving them an amazingly good life and then taking them down really quickly and, you know, as humanely as we can, and just really honoring the fact that when we sit down to a chicken dinner in the middle of the winter, it is the best chicken. I mean, I would never buy a piece of chicken in the supermarket because we've just got fresh, farm-raised, organic chicken that is just the absolute best meat in the world.
Would you say that your diet is mostly plant-based, though?
I would say it's probably 75 to 80% plant-based. we used to eat the, you know, lamb, but now we don't have lamb anymore. So yeah, it's mostly chicken. And if a neighbor, you know, gives us some beef or some pork or something, but mostly plant-based.
Something I, like what you said, caught my eye, like how the hippies were teaching you all this stuff. Can you talk a little bit more about, like, maybe, like, did they help you build this house?
Yeah, it was, like, incredible. So, like I was saying, that when we first moved up to this area, and we were so fortunate to just move in when the Back to the Land movement was, you know, just really cranking. It was full-blown, and it was really successful. And it was like people just embraced us, and there were work parties, you know, just kind of like what you expect, the old barn raising days, you know. You would have a party, and it would be a work party, and everybody understood that they were coming because we were mixing cement and pouring a foundation, and everybody showed up with their babies and their food and, you know, lots of beer and all kinds of different, you know, non-alcoholic things to drink, but it was a party, and it was happening all day, and houses got built because everybody came in, and it was all trade. It was all free trade. It was all people just worked together, and you're going to help me build my house, and I will promise you that I will be there to help you build your house. Yeah, a ton of friends that I can think of, you know, looking at this ceiling, you know, this ceiling was done by two friends of ours, you know, with Bob and us. Yeah, but like, it's really funny, when we were first building, we lived for a long time, we always had running water, but it was just a hand pump, because that was one of the first things we did, is we dug a well, which people kind of say now, like, you literally dug your own well. But I mean, when we came here, we so embraced that idea of that we weren't spending a penny on anything, that it was all coming out of our physical labor. That, yeah, so we spent a summer digging a hole in the ground until we hit water, you know, and that's still the well we use. We kind of went back and forth about electricity, and I was thinking, you know, no, I really want electricity. So we decided that we would get solar panels, because we were trying to not, you know, have any bill coming into the house at all. And so I was the one that learned how to wire the house, you know, because Bob was like, okay, you know, you want electricity, you wire. And I was like, okay, I'll do it, you know. And it was kind of the cool thing about it, because there wasn't anyone that said, you can't wire a house. What are you thinking? You don't know how to wire a house. Like, the whole community was like, hey, we're all, you know, get a book on wiring and learn how to wire a house. And, you know, a couple of guys came by that had a little bit of electrician's background, and they helped me, and yeah, I was like, I wired this house. I did all the electricity in this house, and it hasn't burnt down yet. But that kind of feeling, there wasn't anything that you couldn't do. Hippies that were 10, 12, 15 years older than us that just took us and they mentored us, and they were like, yeah, of course you can wire your own house.
So when you say hippie, what's your definition of a hippie?
Okay, so when I first moved up here, it was guys that had their hair long with beards, people who were very comfortable, kind of comfortable in their own bodies, like you would show up at a party in the summertime and everybody would take their clothes off. But it was that whole, that 60 sense of, they're going to try everything a little bit differently. They're going to push the norm. A lot of summer nudity. I guess, like, people didn't get married, and there was a lot of kind of people switching partners. Like, there are kids that grew up in this area that their father is now, you know, with another woman, and she's just right down the street. Kind of were blended families. Everything was questioning the norm. They're artists. They were musicians. They were kind of funky people, and they just were questioning every moray and value. I guess that's what I think of as a hippie.
Do you distinguish yourself from the hippies? Is it?
I did. When I first came up here, because I did, I was like, well, the hippies were before me. I wasn't the hippie generation, right? Like, where did the hippie generation stop? Like, did the hippie generation stop at the end of Vietnam War? Because if the Vietnam War ended in 75 and hippies stopped being hippies in 75, I didn't graduate high school until 77. But yet my nieces and nephews would say that I was a hippie. Just their memories of spending summers up here, like, you know, in Maine with the hippies. And that's what they'll say. You know, we hung out with the hippies, so. And I don't use the term hippie in any negative way at all. Like, it's a very positive term for me. I truly believe that the hippie movement ended the Vietnam War. That group of people that believed that anything was possible, and that if enough of them were out on the streets marching, that they could end the Vietnam War. You know, that sense of power, which I think they came when they decided to drop out. It wasn't like, we're dropping out because we can't do anything. They were like, we're dropping out because our potential is limitless, and we're going to show the world what we can do.
Did you guys have children?
We didn't. We did not have kids of our own. But one of the things that we did do, we raised foster kids. So we had foster kids live here. We couldn't have kids of our own. So we kind of said, let's get involved with the kids out there that nobody wants. For about 20 years, we raised foster kids. But the other piece about kind of kids, too, is the community up here. Because it was so inclusive, because nobody was working, nobody was doing the 9-to-5 thing, people would just kind of drop over. And, like, everybody was kind of hanging out. They'd come over, and maybe you were working on your garden that day, so they'd help you work in your garden. Or maybe you were working on your house, they'd help you on your house. And they brought their kids with them, right? Because kids went everywhere with these guys. It was a community that raised the kids. There was never a party here that the kids were not a total part of the party. And that's even when, you know, there was a lot of drugs, a lot of pot smoking. You know, the kids just were a part of everything. They weren't taking the drugs, but they were part of, you know, they just, there was nothing that they didn't see. That I think it was just part of that lifestyle and that belief that, you know, they truly believed in what they were doing, and they didn't think anything that they were doing was wrong. So of course the kids are going to see them smoke dope, because they think there's nothing wrong with smoking dope. And really interesting, too, some amazing, amazing kids grew up in this area. We talk about that a lot. Like, a lot of them now have kind of moved away and they live in the cities. But I think it's sort of a reaction to being raised in the woods. But, like, this one kid that grew up in the woods north of us over in Solon, he works in the White House. He's one of the press people for Obama.
Would you say that drugs played a large role in the culture?
Yeah, everything was a go. Everything was okay. Nobody was like, oh, you shouldn't do that. There wasn't that level of hard drugs like there is now, like the heroin and stuff. There was heroin, but it really wasn't back here in the woods. And I think partly because people didn't have the money for it. You know, there wasn't cocaine, but there was tons of dope. And there was a lot of people that's how they were making their money. They were growing a crop and selling a crop of dope. You'd get way more money for dope than you would for carrots. When we first moved up here, we were kind of blown away with that. And then there was a huge shift in the state of Maine when there was a lot of infiltration in the school systems about, you know, getting kids to resist drugs. And so that was really hard for these kids growing up in the woods, because they were going to maybe they weren't being homeschooled, maybe they were going to the public school system, and the authorities in the public school system were telling them this kind of stuff is wrong and not to do it, and yet they were, like, living out in the woods where everybody was smoking pot, and these adults seemed okay. So a lot of people went underground at that point, and they either stopped doing drugs, or if they were continuing to grow for profit, they totally went underground. And all of a sudden you were at a party and nobody was talking about it anymore. It was off the table as a discussion, because people were getting busted, and it was bad. You know, like, the helicopters were coming over, and people were going to jail. And that shift was, like, in the late 80s, early 90s. 70s and in early 80s, they didn't care. They didn't care that people were growing their own dope. And then there was a change in the law where if they caught you growing dope, they could confiscate your property. The law enforcement was making money on busting people.
Did you see resistance from the hippies that...
No resistance, really, because people got pretty freaking scared. Mm-hmm. And at that time, when I say it went underground, it really went underground, because I know that I was not a threat to people, but I stopped hearing about it at all. Could there still be people in my neighborhood that are still growing dope? Possibly, but I know nothing about it. And I think probably people are not growing anymore. I mean, now there's that whole shift of the huge pot growers that are selling the high-end weed. So people who are just growing a little bit of dope in their backyard, they can't even compete. And again, like, that goes back to your question about the hippies. Like, everything was out and on board, and everything was okay. You know what I mean? That nobody came down on anybody else for whatever their lifestyle choice was. So nobody was saying, you know, oh, you shouldn't grow dope. You know, there was no judgment.
Was there any reason that, like, was it a spiritual experience to be, like, partaking in these drugs? Or was it just, like, I can do this and it feels good?
I think so. I think it's the second thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think historically there was that hippie movement. And part of that hippie movement was experimentation, right? Experimentation with free love, experimentation with living a different lifestyle, and drugs were just a part of that experimentation. Along that spectrum, there were people that did it and got really into it, and then there were other people that did it recreationally, and then there were other people who were just like, yeah, that's not for me. But was it spiritual? No, it was just recreational. Mm. I mean, I do not partake at all. I stopped partaking many, many years ago, but it was my personal choice, you know, and I have no problem with anyone that chooses to smoke recreationally.
The hippies that lived here when you first moved, are they mostly gone now?
A lot have gone. A lot. They're actually kind of becoming our elders now, which is really pretty fascinating. So the history of Central Maine, kind of just north of Waterville, Skowhegan, Solon, Athens, Brighton, there was the Skowhegan School of Art, which was started in, I believe, late 40s, 50s. So there was this really kind of bohemian counterculture of artists who would come up and that this school of, which now the Skowhegan School of Art is actually very renowned. You apply to go to the Skowhegan School of Art, and it's very hard to get into it. So some of those first artists that knew of this area because of the Skowhegan School of Art bought old farms and were living here. So, like, they were kind of the first original hippies. As with anything, people would maybe spend a summer up here and then go back to school and go, oh, you know, man, I was just spent the summer up in this really cool town in Central Maine. There's all kinds of really great groovy things happening in there. And so people would come and go. So it was a very fluid community. When we first moved up here in the early 80s was probably, like I've said, like, now in retrospect, I realize it was the height of it. But maybe already the beginning of a little bit of people moving away and just going on to do different things. But yes, it's still a good amount of people that live up here. The other piece too, which that is really kind of cool of this area is, have you guys seen any of the footage from the Athens parades? So when we first moved up here, that was like full-blown, right? The parade was going, and it was crazy, crazy counterculture. And if you weren't in the parade, you were watching the parade. And if you weren't a part of the play, you were watching the play. It was just this amazing community of people. And kind of the history of West Athens is that West Athens was already a bit of a notorious town historically. They were rum runners during the Prohibition. So there was already this community of West Athenians that kind of took care of themselves. They were already considered, like, a bit lawless. Like, people even in the area would be like, okay, yeah, that's West Athens, right? You know, and that's, like, back in the 50s. So the story, and this is a story before my time, but the story I've heard by many of the old hippies is that when they landed in West Athens, partly because of the artists that had been in the Skowhegan area and just coming up and trying to buy pieces of land. Like, it was cheap up here, right? You could rent a house for nothing. When they first moved into West Athens, which I think is not true of other areas where people tried to start communes or start moving back to the land, there was a lot of resistance from the locals. In West Athens, there was no resistance. I've heard stories where hippies moved into West Athens and there was a knock on the door from a local who said, "Do you guys smoke pot? Can you teach us how to grow some of that?" Because they were just like right into it. They were like, okay, we're going to grow this illegal thing and make money on it, you know? So there was this combining of the cultures of the locals that I don't think happened in a lot of other places, which is why I think this area got really huge, because the counterculture was embraced by the Brighton people, the Athens people, and they were just already, I hate to say odd, but they were already just a very different kind of people. So they were not like, oh, you know, you can't be in my backyard, you can't be next to me. They were like, yeah, come on, bring it on. They were loving it.
Were there parts that you didn't like about the community?
Yes, let me say this, which I thought was really fascinating. There was the hippie movement. There was the anti-war movement. There was the feminist movement. There was the black movement. A lot of those, the feminist movement came out of the anti-war. And so there were a lot of men when I first moved up here, because realize that I'm like 10, 12, 15 years younger than them. I was really steeped in the feminist movement, because those older women who had started the feminist movement, they were already, like when I was in high school, that I was already hearing about that, and it was already being really embraced, you know, that whole burning of the bras and women being able to do any job that a man can do. So I was already very steeped in the feminist movement, and really kind of, I made this huge misnomer that every hippie was also going to be a feminist. And when I first moved up here, I was kind of blown away that there were a lot of older men who, what I considered were like anti-war, were anti-government, were all those kind of, you know, free love, all those kind of hippie things that you would think that they were very liberal, but they were also incredibly misogynist. Like, women were second-class citizens. And I can remember being like blown away by that, thinking like, wow, how can you have embraced everything else and not embrace this piece, still being very chauvinist? So that was an eye-opener for me, because I was kind of like, oh, okay, you can kind of be a hippie, but you can still have your issues. You can still have your prejudices. Mm. And then also, too, I would have to say that some of the people were a little bit more free love, a little bit more like, oh, it's cool if people sleep around and stuff. That was just not my thing. It was not my thing at all, and Bob and I are very monogamous. So it was like, I didn't want to judge people for that, but that was totally not something that I was going to get involved in. So I picked and chose what I wanted to embrace, because it was a very large back-to-the-land movement up here and a very large counterculture. So it was easy enough to pick your friends that felt the same way you did. Like, we definitely ended up hanging out more with people who were in a long-term relationship. When you were at a party, everybody was there, and everybody hung out with everybody, but there were core groups of people.
How do you think homesteading changes with age?
Oh, it becomes much harder. Much, much, much harder. And in fact, I think that we're really witnessing that now, is that the original back-to-the-landers, the original homesteaders, are now leaving the area. And they're partly leaving the area because Maine is such a tough place to survive in the winter. And if you still live in a house that you're heating with wood, maybe you don't have running water, maybe you don't have electricity, it's going to be much harder to survive a Maine winter than it is like if you were homesteading in North Carolina or homesteading in Arizona or Florida, right? So people are leaving for the winters. Some people are selling their property outright and leaving. And actually, what's a really interesting thing that's happening right now, we kind of have not paid that much attention to it because we're not there yet, is that there is now a little bit of a movement of really starting kind of communal places to live as they age. Like, we have some friends that are part of a very intentional community now that they built over in Belfast, where people are kind of retiring to, but it's kind of old hippies. So they're still kind of like that same philosophy, mm-hmm. and they are building where they're sharing a grid. So what will we do in 10 years from now? Who knows? We talk about that a lot, but Bob is always like, I don't want to think about it. Because it is. You know, God forbid, you know, if he hurt himself or blew his back out or something, we'd be, you know, in pretty tough straits, you know, because it is still a very physical lifestyle.
Especially with couples, did you see any disintegration?
Oh, like, what totally, yeah.
Was, like, the tensions that...
Yeah, I know, and some of it is so... I mean, I almost feel like I'm gossiping or telling stories about the community, but there's been some pretty bizarre things, and maybe they happen out in the suburbs, but people just keep it under wraps, you know, whereas out here, because it's kind of part of the community, everybody knows everybody's business. And it's been really interesting to watch the children that evolved from that, you know, because you want to kind of say, oh, these kids are going to be messed up, like, oh my God. But you know what? It's intriguing because they're not. And I think part of the reason that they're not is even though there was a lot of, like, adults that were switching partners, the kids were loved very much, and the community loved them, and there was a real sense of that everybody was taking care of each other's kids, and that kids were going to be raised with love and with openness and with honesty. There was a couple of hippies up north of us who had, like, a man and a woman who had five kids together, and then he just kind of he never even left her. He just moved in with another woman and started having another family. So when we, like, moved up here, there was this guy who had two families. Well, that's really weird, right? Like, that, now we're kind of talking Mormonism stuff, polygamy. But that was part of, like, the hippie movement, is that you didn't come down on other people. You know, you didn't say, you're wrong, I'm right, you do it my way. So it was all, everybody just kind of said, yeah, all right, this is really weird. So did I approve? Maybe not. But it's kind of interesting to also be part of the community and watch the fallout of that. And there really doesn't seem to be any, you know? So it's like, so you're saying, okay, well, societally we say that that's wrong, you know? And I think it's wrong, but yet I'm watching that, you know, thinking, well, now there's going to be a major fallout. And then there isn't. It's just kind of part of life. Yeah, like lots of people who came up with a partner moved to a different partner, move to another different partner, but are all still part of the community. You know what I mean? So a guy that will have had children with three different women in the area, or four different women in it. I mean, like, a lot of that was going on. And people were cool with it. People were fine with it. There was nobody saying, you can't do it, or that's wrong for you to do. But did everybody partake? No. There was a lot of monogamy and a lot of people who stayed in singular relationships.
I was also wondering about the education of the kids,
yeah.
and how that evolved, and how you educated your foster children.
So, because our foster children were wards of the state, our kids went to school, and we were fine with that. It was a little bit before my time, but there was the very first hippies and Back to the Landers that moved up here, they made their own school. And you talk to a lot of the kids that went to that school, and it was just like your mother's friend who taught you math and another friend who taught you. And then there was a lot of homeschooling, and that was before the state really got involved in homeschooling, and it was not illegal. And then at some point, the state got down on homeschoolers. There was just certain things that had to be done legally to prove that you were educating your child. A lot of homeschoolers up here. And then at some point, I think because hippie parents were very much into free will and that, I think there was a lot when kids were like, all right, I am so sick of being homeschooled. I want to be out in the world and, like, out in school where I can at least hang out with other kids during the day. There was a lot of pushback from the kids. And that's, I think, how a lot of kids ended up going to school, is that they were like, all right, I'm sixth grade, and I'm sick of this.
Yeah.
I want to go to school. But I'll have to say, and Bob and I say it all the time, we have the most... The kids that grew up in this area are the most amazing human beings. There's just been some amazing stuff. I've just watched them head out into the world, and there's nothing they can't do. And I think it's because there were limitations, but there weren't many. They wrote their own rules. I think the fallout from that is it created a lot of incredibly free-thinking people, like one of those kids that I was just telling you of that came out of that kind of combined family. He lives in upstate New York, and he's growing his own hops and making his own beer, and he's got a huge beer business now where he's bottling, and he's got a microbrew. And then there was another one of the kids that to work in Washington, D.C. Some kids that went down to the coast and they're lobstering, and just a lot of skills. They knew how to work with their hands. We're very self-sufficient. There was nothing that they couldn't do. In intellectual, too, but just really, if you were going to be stranded on a desert island with someone, you'd pick one of these kids to be stranded on a desert island with. Yeah, I think it created a really amazing group of young adults. But I also think that it's over, for lack of a better word, because these kids are not continuing. They have left. They have gone away. Some of them, like I know one girl who grew up in the commune in Seoul, and she lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts now, and her girls are actually in high school and going to college. And she's really kind of hot to move back and to move back onto the land. And she's one of the first second-generationers that is like, it's kind of interesting to see that she wants to come back up here.
I was going to ask about, so most of the children basically just leave?
Yeah, for sure. They all love it here. They love coming back here. Like, they all come back for the 4th of July, because the 4th of July is a huge party. Mm-hmm. And they all come back for that because it's kind of the tribe coming back together. But none of them live here. They're all gone. And funny enough, most of them are in cities. But I think that's kind of that immediate reaction. So it'll be interesting to see what they do as they grow older. They're mostly in their 20s and 30s now.
All right, I think... Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
This was great.